Live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, downtown in the heart of the Byward Market. Welcome to Sunday Night. Here's Rabbi Balka.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our program. We're delighted that you are joining us, and it's been an eventful week, and much of the news has been, shall we say, consumed by the great successful visit of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, first to Canada, culminating, of course, in Calgary. Probably the big highlight was the visit to Slave Lake and lifting up the spirits of the people there who really were down and out for, well, you know, what they have gone through is nothing short of tragic. You can imagine an entire city burnt down. It's beyond our imagination. And many things that happened. I find it almost ironic at the very same time that the best things from England were coming our way. The worst things of England were coming out in Great Britain with that scandal of the newspaper, which ended its publications today. It will no longer see the light of day, but whether the people that were responsible for this won't find themselves in some other configurations and doing some of the nasty things that they were doing with this paper, that's another story. The good news for us is that we are really blessed tonight to be able to talk to an individual who has done marvelous things with her pen over the course of a very distinguished career. No scandals here, folks, just good writing. And hopefully for 2 hours tonight, very good talking. It's a great pleasure to welcome for the first time to our program Barbara Florio Graham. Barbara, welcome.
Well, hello, and it's so nice to be a guest on your program. I'm delighted.
It's great to have you, and I thank you for, shall we say, dedicating 2 hours of your precious time, and especially on a Sunday night when you could be probably doing a lot better things, to speak with us and to our into our audience. Let's make sure that people appreciate who you are. You're quite an accomplished author, but let me go back to your original roots. You were supposed to be a boy, right?
Yes, my parents had two girls, and they were absolutely sure that the third child was going to be a boy.
Did you ever find out from them what made them so sure? Because I would say that if you did twice a girl, the chances are the next one's going to be a girl, too.
Well, they lived in a flat downstairs from my mother's brother and his wife, and my mother and my aunt were pregnant twice at the same time. My aunt had a boy and then a boy. My mother had a girl and a girl, and my sisters have, actually all three of us, have cousins almost exactly the same age, born within a month of each other. So when they both got pregnant again, they said, well, Phyllis said, for sure I'm going to have a girl, and my mother said, well, for sure I'm going to have a boy. And they were so sure that they actually had names picked out. Aunt Phyllis had a girl's name picked out, and along came James. And my mother had a boy's name picked out, which was Robert. So they were calling me Bobby before I was born.
Oh. And this was before the age when you could actually see the stuff on ultrasound.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was, can I admit this? This was in 1934.
Well, we'll conveniently forget it because you don't sound anywhere near that.
Well, I don't feel anywhere near that. But, you know, this book that I want to talk to you about tonight was edited by two of us in our 70s, and the age range of the contributors is 43 to 78, four decades.
You're not the 78. You're the close.
No, well,
you're
I'm close. A little bit younger than that.
Right. But I don't think anybody listening to you now would guess that that's your age.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm young in spirit and young in terms of continuing to work. I love what I do. I'm the author of three books. As you mentioned, I'm a publishing consultant. I'm a columnist for three publications. I keep really, really busy.
Right. And you, when you were 9 years old, you won a regional award in National Scholastics Writing?
No, that was when I was, I think, 12. When I was 9, I was first published.
Oh, that was your first published. You won the award you won in 12.
I was paid for a poem in Humpty Dumpty magazine when I was 9 years old. I said, "You mean I can write the way I like to write and get paid for it? You're kidding."
And they said yes.
They said yes. Then I had another run.
Then you take a look at the people that are playing baseball, and you know what? If they strike out, they still get paid.
That's right. Well, I learned very early on that that you could get paid if you write well enough.
Right. In those days, they weren't paying big bucks, I would imagine.
Well, they paid $5. You know, considering the length of the poem, that's better pay than a lot of us get these days.
Yeah, well, $5 all the way back was a lot of money.
Oh, it certainly was. And a free subscription to the magazine for the next year, which I think cost $5 as well.
So you actually made 10. So we're going to interrupt our conversation from time to time when I see the clock coming up to our intermission times.
Okay.
So this is the first one of them, but the next one is a little bit longer. This is the first one coming off the news, so it's a little bit of a shorter time. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Barbara Florio Graham, who has some interesting stories to tell and a great book that we're going to be talking about tonight. But before we get to the book, we want to know the lady behind it. We're back right after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our program. And we're delighted to have with us for the full Monty, shall we say, the full 2 hours of our program, a very distinguished writer, Barbara Florio Graham, was to be a Bobby. Bobby became Barbara because the boy actually was a girl. Is a girl.
Still is.
Right. Lots of books you've done. Your first book was Five Fast Steps to Better Writing?
Yeah, that I brought out the 20th anniversary edition of that in 2005. It's a very popular book.
Right. So could you give us, because I know there's probably a lot of people who say, you know, I wish I could write. And I've often heard people say the best way to become a writer is to write. Would you subscribe to that?
Yes, but the best way to become a really good writer is to read good writing. If you read books that are written well, you tend to then begin to speak and to write in that same fashion. I love to teach writing. I'm still teaching writing. I mentor other writers, and I mentor authors in how to get their books published, because I'm also a publishing consultant. And I can always tell right away if someone writes reasonably well or not. If you don't write very well, a good editor can certainly help you. But if you can't write at all, there's really no help for that. And most of these people who can't write well at all are people who don't read widely and don't read good authors.
Well, I can tell you, I teach at one of the local universities. And I am on some occasions appalled at the absolutely horrible grammar of people. And I say, how did they ever graduate high school to get into university? On the other hand, you have some whose writing is exceptional. It's a sort of a it's a mixed bag, and it doesn't it's not exciting, because I would say the weight more are bad writers than are good writers. And it's not because they're stupid. It's because they don't know how to put sentences together.
It has nothing to do with that. My mother was a great reader, and my mother was a wonderful writer. She had poetry published. She had songs published. She wrote really, really well, and I've saved a lot of her letters, which are beautifully written, lovely descriptions of places they went and things they did.
Good.
And she had only a grade 8 education, but she read everything she could get her hands on. When I was a child growing up, she subscribed to a Book of the Month Club, and she read Reader's Digest cover to cover and did the word power. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, those 20 words in each monthly edition, yeah.
Exactly. Right. So this is how you create a good writer if you're a parent. One of the best writers I know was a very close friend of mine who never went to university, and you'd never know it. She writes better than many, many university graduates. Some of it is talent. A lot of it is skill, and a lot of it is what you're exposed to. If you read good writing, you tend to write the same way. I was a voracious reader as a child, and I wrote from the time I was very small.
Who are your favorite writers?
Well, my favorite writer is actually someone who was born in the same town I was, in Hamden, Connecticut, just outside of New Haven, Thornton Wilder.
Oh!
And Thornton Wilder is a favorite of a great many authors. Timothy Finley said he was his favorite writer as well, and I was just a devotee of his books. I also read, because I'm an American, I read all of the American classics. I love Steinbeck. I loved the playwrights because I was a theater major, so I loved Eugene O'Neill and George Bernard Shaw. And my favorite author of all time, of course, is Shakespeare. I am an amateur Shakespeare scholar. I love, adore Shakespeare, and I see everything I can see. I've seen all 37 plays in live performance, and to me, that sets the bar very high.
The Bard. The Bar or the Bard?
Both.
So is Wilder the guy who wrote on Golden Pond
no,
or whatever?
No. Thornton Wilder wrote Our Town.
Our Town, right.
The one
right.
You know.
So I'm going back. This is going back all the way to my childhood. But it's interesting that a lot of great writers in the States came from New England.
Yes, they did. Robert Frost, he's one of my favorite poets, was a New Englander as well. And we breed good people in New England.
That's where you come from. So how?
Yes, I come from Connecticut.
You moved to Canada in centennial year, right? The
67. Yes, I did. Yeah, I went to Barnard College in New York, which is the women's
division of
Columbia
right?
University.
Yeah.
And that's where the story that I have in Prose to Go is set. My story in this anthology it takes place at Barnard College.
We're going to keep that for later. We want people to stay tuned. We don't give up. We don't give out our ace right at the beginning of the card game.
Well, that's because I'm so excited about the book.
Yeah. We haven't even gotten to that book yet because we're still talking about your other books.
Okay.
Right.
Well, third book.
So the five fast steps to better writing is 20th anniversary edition. Actually, was launched at City Hall, right? It was in 1995. So you did 20 editions in 10 years. That's pretty...
No, I didn't do 20 editions. I did the 20th anniversary edition.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay. So how many...
In 2005.
There
you
go.
But the book was so popular, I needed to update an updated edition. All the resources in the original book, of course, were in print, and I did a whole new resources section with all websites.
And in 1990, you got the Communicator of the Year Award.
From International Association of Business Communicators, yeah.
And that was because of the book, The Five Fast Steps to Low-Cost Publicity?
Mm-hmm, yes. They were very impressed with that book, which I was thrilled by. That's my little bestseller. It's very strange. It's a spiral-bound manual. It's not in bookstores. It's not because it doesn't shelve well. And I've never changed it because one of the first reviewers said, this is a good reason why you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. And I love that. And I thought, okay, I will never change the cover.
Right.
But it was put out as a teaching manual, and it just became so extremely popular, and it still sells very well.
So I know that a lot of people think that the way to get low-cost publicity is to go mooning in the middle of a baseball game on center field. But that's not what you were writing about.
No, and actually, this was written, of course, long before Facebook and Twitter and all of that.
For sure.
And there are now, those are very good ways to get publicity. But I was talking about the old-fashioned kind of publicity, and that is writing short articles for community newspapers that didn't read like a press release, that they could pick up and run as a short article. That's one example. Sending information to the media about an event that you're going to have far enough in advance for their deadlines. A lot of people have no idea how early the deadlines are. I used to be the entertainment editor for What's On in Ottawa. Do you remember that little publication?
Absolutely.
It later became Where. And I was the entertainment editor, and I wrote the publicity book because I was so upset at people who were missing out on wonderful publicity because I got their information either incomplete and I didn't have time to call them back and check it before my deadline, or it didn't come in on time. And I thought, you know, people really need to learn how to do this. And then I handled publicity. I've done a number of PR contracts. I worked for a big PR firm in the States, in New York, for a while, and I did a number of publicity contracts here in Canada for the Christmas Exchange, the Ottawa School of Art, the Catholic Health Association, people like that. But I did a great big one for the National Square and Round Dance Association when they had their second annual conference in Ottawa. At that point, it was the biggest convention that Ottawa had ever hosted. It was down at the Civic Center. And I handled all the publicity for that, and it was extremely successful. And everybody said to me, what's the formula? How do you do this? And I thought, I need to write this down. So I did.
Wow, very good. Cats, you're a cat lover?
Well, I'm a cat person. Yes, I love cats, but I love all animals.
You know that you're not the most famous cat lover in Canada.
Well, no, Stephen Harper and Laureen Harper, I guess, take that.
That's right.
But my cat is the most famous cat in Canada.
Really?
Simon Teakettle was on the CBC for 25 years. That's a long time.
That's longevity. What is the normal lifespan of a cat?
Well, a well-cared-for indoor cat that's given all the proper veterinary care and is spayed and neutered will live easily 20 years. The very first Simon Teakettle that I got when he was a year and a half old, so he didn't have the best of care in his very first few years, lived to 17. Simon Teakettle the second was 19, and I now have Simon Teakettle the third. He's 5 this summer. And it's important to not, the cats that don't live very long are the purebred cats. A cat that is a mixed breed often gets the best of everything. They're much stronger physically. They tend to be more healthy. You know, it's very interesting. Now, you have to take care of them. You have to get them, give them good veterinary care.
And we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with that, and then we'll get into some of the other books. We're talking to Barbara Florio-Graham. If you want to join in the conversation, if you have any questions to ask about writing, about reading, our numbers are 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 800-580-2372. You will not want to miss the extraordinary story that Barbara has to tell, but I'm not telling you about it until we get to it. And rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. We're back right after these messages.
Now, back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bolka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our program. Our numbers are 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility is a free call. 800-580-2372 is our toll-free number. rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. And we are in the midst of a conversation with Barbara Florio-Graham. And we will tell you soon about her latest opus. But before that, we're still finding out lots about her. This is a lady who has accomplished a lot in her life, and there's still more gas in the tank, right, Barbara?
Oh, yes, plenty.
That's good. So we were talking about cats and what you need to do to nurture them well.
Well, you just need to take care of them, need to feed them properly and give them proper health care and train them. I won a $1,000 prize for an article called How to Train Your Cat Like a Dog. That article was published a couple of times and earned a lot of money and then this $1,000 prize, I give it away free on my website. My website is named after the cat, so the website is www.simonteakettle.com.
That's your website.
That's my website.
Right.
Well, it's his website. He owns the company, you know.
Oh, I see. Does he have his own lawyer, or you are acting on his behalf?
No, he doesn't have his own lawyer, but he has his own bank account. He owns the website. He owns the email account. He's my boss.
Now, that's probably the most enterprising cat in captivity.
Oh, he is. He is. He's extremely well known. He's been quoted on websites all over the world.
Is he running for office soon?
Well, we thought about that because he is a Canadian citizen. We'll just have to consider that. This one would be a very appealing candidate.
I actually would probably get in trouble for this, but I say he could run in Quebec because some people got elected there that never showed up and never had a platform. This cat probably would have a good platform to run on.
Well, you know, he doesn't speak French, but we could arrange that.
I seem to remember there was someone who didn't speak French there either.
That's right. It's a strange province.
Look, I'll tell you what. If he can speak English, I think that'll be good enough.
I think he could run federally. I don't think he would run provincially. I think he would run federally.
Really? Why? Oh, yeah. Is that small potatoes provincial stuff?
No,
he must have been big time.
He's big enough for a national audience.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay. Very interesting. Another book that you've written is called Musings, Mewsings.
That was co-written with the cat.
It says Barbara and Simon Teakettle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much of it was him and how much of it was you?
Oh, it's half and half. It's a flip book. So there are 10 pieces, poems and short articles by him. And on the other side, there are 10 by me. And we're back-to-back with two covers. The front cover is his. It has a cat on it. And the back cover is mine, which has a butterfly on it. And this was a book that I had to write because Simon Teakettle II insisted that after I had two books, he had to have a book.
And
so we compromised.
Now, it's interesting, too, that there is such a thing as a Cat Writers Association.
Oh, yeah. It's a very big international association.
Who put this together?
Well, a woman in Texas who has written a great many authoritative cat books. She's written a complete book of kitten care. Her name is Amy Shojai, and she's written all the Purina cat guides. She's very, very well known, as I think, 20 books or so to her in her background. And she decided that there were a number of other cat lovers that she knew and cat writers that she knew. And she said, we need an association. And she started it about 25 years ago. It's been going, as I say, it's international. They have a huge international contest. That's where I won my $1,000 award, is in one of their contests.
Right.
And last year, I won the Shojai, named after her, mentoring award. From them, which was came with $500 U.S. It was I was taken totally by surprise. It was an absolutely wonderful thing to win.
You know what would be a good idea for you? You may have done this already, but being that the Prime Minister and the First Lady are such cat lovers, they probably would love your book on Musings.
Sent him copy of the book
when
he was first elected.
Right?
No, not even a response from anybody saying, we received the book, thank you. Nothing.
I guarantee if you send it now, you'll get a different response. That probably could have been at the beginning of the tenure, and the office may not have been put.
No, I sent it the first year he was in office. I sent it for his birthday. I sent it as a birthday gift.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to send him another copy.
Because it may have gotten lost.
Well, that's true. Maybe he'll listen, or someone of his aides will listen to your program and will.
Because he is, generally speaking, quite a good responder.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, so I would give him the benefit of the doubt and send it again.
Well, it's available everywhere. It's available very close to him. It's at Books on Beechwood. All my books are at Books on Beechwood. Among other places. So he could always pick up a copy there.
Yeah, but he may not know about the book. And
he
may not be listening to our program tonight.
Well, shame on him if he's not listening to you, Rabbi Bulka.
He got better things to do. But
shame on him.
I would actually take a chance and send it again. Well, I'm sure he would love it.
I may do that.
It's worth it.
I may do that.
And now, finally, Barbara, we got to the book that actually brings us together tonight, which is quite a fascinating book. It's called Pros to Go.
Mm-hmm. Tales from a Private List.
Now, let's talk a little bit. This private list is fascinating.
It's my private list.
I know. So tell us about it. This is not anything like the list of that newspaper in England that had to close.
No.
This is legal, and you don't hack into anyone.
No, that's right.
Right, okay.
There are many organizations that have email lists that you subscribe to, or you belong to the organization. You have a right to have the list. And, you send emails back and forth. And many organizations that I belong to have lists like this. And very often they are very large. You know, there may be 50, 100 200 people on the list. You only know a handful of them. You don't know all of them by any means. And it feels kind of anonymous. And so you will send professional information to the list, which we all do. There's a CAT writer's list. There's a list for the writer's deadline here in Ottawa, a really good writer's list. You'll send professional information to them or opinions, or you'll share information. But you don't usually talk about really private things because you don't know all these people. So in August 2007, I decided I wanted to form a private list. And I asked a number of my close friends from the Professional Writers Association of Canada that has a huge list. And I said, what would you think about a private list? And a number of them, there are 23 of us, were interested. And we formed this list, which we very soon afterwards closed to new members because we realized we had kind of a magic number. 23 is small enough that everybody really feels like they know each other. And even some of the people on the list have never met each other. There are a couple of people on the list that I've never met, but I knew them by email, and we'd become very close friends. And I didn't realize until after the list was going for a while how diverse it was. We're Catholics and Protestants and Jews and agnostics and atheists. We're young people married with small children. We're divorced people. We're grandparents. We're dealing with elderly parents. We're dealing with teenage kids. We're dealing with illness. We're dealing with somebody has a bipolar spouse. Somebody has an autistic son. Somebody has a handicapped daughter. During the course of the list, their books have been published. People have won significant awards. So we're celebrating everything, life's ups and downs and joys and sorrows, frustration. And we give each other practical suggestions and empathy and comfort, as well as professional advice.
It's interesting. It is almost like a private chat room.
It is. That's exactly what it is. Except it's a closed list in that it's not available. It's not on the web. It is just within email. So that and we have a very strict rule that nothing ever gets posted outside the list. You never copy anybody else. You never forward anything to anybody else without permission.
And you haven't had any leaks?
No.
That is absolutely amazing.
Well, that's because it's such a small group. And it's a very tight group. It's a group of very thoroughly professional people, all of them, well-published writers. A couple of them have published their own books. They have publishing companies. We have Seacroft and PEI. We have River Rocks Publishing in Thunder Bay. We have people who have really very strong credentials. And as a result, they have a great deal of respect for each other. And I'm absolutely thrilled that I did this. I can't believe that I was able to pull this together. And then last year when they said, we want to do a book, there are so many good things that have been on this list.
Okay, right here I'm going to stop you. And when I come back, that's where we're going to start off, because now it's getting a little bit hot and heavy. And
good.
we have to take a break for some commercials. And when we come back, we're going to get right to the nitty-gritty with Barbara Florio-Graham. Our number is 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 800-580-2372 is our toll-free number, and rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. We will be back right after these messages.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bulka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the first hour of our program. Delighted to have with us our special guest for the entire program tonight, Barbara Florio-Graham. She is a very distinguished and published and awarded author. And we are talking tonight mainly about her latest book, which is a book which is done in collaboration with two others. And we're going to get to that in a few seconds. I just wanted to give you our numbers in case you wanted to join the conversation. 613-521-8255 is our main number. Star 580 on Bell Mobility if you have a Bell Mobility phone system. 800-580-2372 is our toll-free number. And rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. So, Barbara, we were in the midst of, so you got this idea that there was so much good stuff that was being shared in this group. So take us from there on.
Well, we decided we wanted to put together an anthology. And I said, you know, no way we're going to do this unless we already have a publisher on board, because we're not going to do the work of drawing this together without a publisher guaranteeing that he would publish it. But fortunately, among our colleagues, a very close friend of many of us, is a publisher in Dundas, Ontario, Bridge Ross. So that's bridgeross.com. And Marvin, when I approached, Marvin had just published last year a humor book written by one of our members, Steve Pitt. And actually, it's Steve's photograph that graces the cover of Prose to Go. So I said, you know, why don't we contact Marvin? And I said, I'll do that. So I contacted Marvin, and Marvin said, oh, yeah.
Marvin,
well,
people
know. Marvin Ross of Bridge
Ross. Right, right.
So he said, oh, yeah, I know most of you, and I know how well all of you write, and I certainly would be interested in the book. He said, I can't say definitely yes until I, you know, see some samples.
That's a typical publisher. No,
well,
no,
of course.
No, it's not, unless your name is Shakespeare.
No, but I mean,
that's
standard. I mean, I'm a publishing consultant.
Yeah,
I know
fine.
That.
Yeah.
But I knew that he would be happy with the samples, because he did know most of us and knows our writing. So I got back to the group and I said, okay, we have Marvin on board. Now we have to get a good enough compilation things to make a full book and to live up to the standards that Marvin is expecting. So we decided that there would be three editors. I took on managing editor, because that's what I do, to look at the format of the book and the layout, and I helped design the cover and pull those things together. I recruited Irene Davis, who is the most respected editor among our group, wonderful, wonderful editor and grammarian, as the primary editor. And Fred Desjardins, who's a great guy that everybody loves, who's also worked as an editor and a humor writer. He lives in Halifax. Irene lives in Toronto. And we said, okay, the three of us are going to do this, and everything is going to be done entirely by email, if you can imagine that. And we ended up with 34 first-person stories from 18 of the 23 people on the list. And these people come from 14 different locations, from the Northwest Territories to PEI. If you can imagine doing this back and forth and back and forth, and we did it all in about 5 months.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because writers write, and they therefore, they're the easiest ones to get to do something like this because it's in their DNA.
Well, and everybody was wonderful. And Irene and Fred and I got along beautifully. We had so much fun. We did a tremendous amount of work. We were on email every single day, including Hanukkah and Christmas. We took almost no time off. Irene's husband said at one point, "Darling, do you have any idea how many times you have communicated with Fred and Barbara today?" And she said, "No, I don't." And she asked us, and I said, "Let's not try to count." It was a lot of fun, and the contributors were very cooperative. And the people who didn't contribute are members of the list who don't write the kind of thing that we were looking for in this book. In this book, we were looking for, and these are what the section titles are, we were looking for misadventures, rearview mirror.
That's something like a Steven Spielberg movie, right?
Yeah. What in the world is another section.
Right, so items in this mirror are closer than they seem or something like that. Love and loss, and then the final one was exit laughing.
Well, we knew we'd have humor, and we knew we would have love and loss because one of the first things that happened in the midst of discussing this was that one of our members in Montreal lost her husband very suddenly. And she wrote to us the morning he died, and the most moving piece I have ever read in my life. Everybody was in tears. We were all back to her immediately. What can we do? How can we help? We had two members in Montreal who were friends of hers who immediately, you know, called and went over and rallied and then collected donations from us for the Heart Institute there. But anyway, that piece, we said, this has got to be in the book if we're going to do a book. And then another one of our members had lost her son to suicide just a year before. And she said, if Barbara's strong enough and brave enough to share this, then I'm going to share something about Paul. So she wrote a piece. So we knew we had that, and we knew we had humor because we had Steve Pitt, and Fred's a humor writer, and I have several humor pieces, and we have wonderful humor writers from Peterborough, from London, Ontario. And so we knew we'd have that. We said, well, what else? That's not enough for a book, and those things are too far apart.
Right.
So we began to ask, and the three editors, we began to say, tell us about your misadventures. And I knew Helena Katz from the Northwest Territories had shared with us already the story about bringing a herd of alpacas across northern Alberta up to the Northwest Territories in a truck. Can you imagine?
Mm.
And that's the first story in the book. It's not funny per se, but it's absolutely wonderful, and it certainly is a misadventure. And when we said, what other misadventures can you guys come up with? Well, then, of course, we got a bunch of others. And you've got to understand that many of these pieces were previously published. We said, look, we don't expect you to write all original material. Send us stuff that's been published, but it's published perhaps not that widely. We have things from the Christian Science Monitor. We have things from Stitches magazine, which is a humor magazine.
Even Ottawa Citizen you have.
Well, yeah, we have the Ottawa Citizen, a couple of pieces of mine, the Peterborough Examiner, the London Free Press, the Charlottetown paper, the Kings County Record in New Brunswick, small papers, Peterborough Examiner, small papers where they wouldn't have had a huge national audience, but they deserved a wider audience. So we began to get misadventures. Then we got quite a few rearview mirror pieces, which were really nice. And then the sections began to develop. And the central the middle section, What in the World, ended up called What in the World because we said, what are we going to do with these pieces? They don't fit anywhere else.
Well, that's very interesting. You know what? This is a very helpful for a person, let's say, wants to put a book together. I've been in that position, you know, when I put together a few books of my articles in the Ottawa Citizen.
Right.
And it's interesting how these things, somehow or other, you get an inspiration when you see a few that come together and you say, what, you know, this looks like a good heading for a section. And mm-hmm. then somehow or other, you then fit other ones into it that you would not have thought of otherwise. So
well,
I can see how that goes. But by the way, I have good news for you. We're actually done with the first hour, and we haven't even gotten to the real, the real, shall we say, the most, I should say, appropriate, timely piece, which we're going to get to when we turn the corner into the second hour. So we're going to take a leave, Barbara, now, and wish you well. And stay tuned, because right after the 10 o'clock news, we'll continue our conversation with Barbara Florio Graham, who is the managing editor, I guess is the right way of putting it, the managing editor, but one of the co-authors of Prose to Go, Tales from a Private List, a great book. We're going to tell you more about it when we get back after the 10 o'clock news. Stay tuned.
Let's get back to the Rabbi. Sunday night with Rabbi Bulka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour of our program. Delighted that you are with us. And we spent the first hour getting to know our guest, Barbara Florio Graham, who is the author of many books. Probably nice to say about her that she's a writer's writer. She is not only a writer, but she tells writers how to write, or helps writers to write, which is the better way of, let's say, instead of telling people how to catch fish for them, you basically tell them how to catch the fish. It's a lot better. And what you do is you generate lots of good things by giving people that or shall we say, enhancing their abilities. Our numbers, by the way, 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 800-580-2372, our toll-free number. rbulk@cfra.com is our email address. Now, I understand that this is not the type of a program which is going to generate lots of calls, because it's more about learning about someone and learning about a great book. The book is called Prose to Go. It's published by Bridge Ross Communications. Its subtitle is Tales from a Private List. It's edited by Irene Davis, Fred Desjardins, and Barbara Florio Graham, our guest. And it's available, and it's a, by the way, it's this is a hot off the press book. Barbara, when was it first released?
It was released in May.
So it's hot. This is hot.
Yes, it is hot. It's been being launched in various places. You know, their writers come from, contributors come from 14 different locations. So it's being launched at different places at different times. It's been launched in New Brunswick the beginning of June, and it was launched here at Books on Beechwood on the 25th of June. It is being, you know, as I say, it's being launched various different places depending upon the author's availability. The author from the Northwest Territories is traveling right now, so she won't do her launch until probably later in the summer. But we aren't concerned about that, because it's out there. It's gotten wonderful reviews already. It's available at Chapters and on Amazon and at all sorts of independent bookstores. You can ask for it at any independent bookstore, and they can order it from bridgeross.com. It, as I say, it's here at Books on Beechwood right now.
And it actually was reviewed in the New York Journal of Books, which is, that's from what I remember, quite a...
That's a fabulous review.
Yeah.
That was the first review to come in, and you have no idea how excited we were when they said memoirs in miniature. Fred said, that's exactly how we were describing the book ourselves. And it's just, you know, she says... they possess an immediacy and a realism that's appealing in its authenticity. Can you ask for anything better than that? We were over the moon.
That's great. And the other thing that we should not lose sight of is that the writers are Canadian.
Oh, they're all Canadian. They're all Canadian professional journalists, people who have written for a variety of people whose names you'll recognize. Mark Kearney, for example, our contributor from London, Ontario, is the co-author with Randy Ray, who lives in Ottawa, of the Canadian trivia books.
Right. And Randy is frequently behind the scenes garnering up guests for our show with people.
Yes, he's a professional publicist as well as a wonderful writer.
Right.
And Mark has been his writing partner for many, many years. Gordon Gibb from Peterborough, who wrote the hilarious hot tub incident in Prose to Go, and a couple of others. Gord is a professional broadcaster in Peterborough. Julie Watson, who wrote the very funny piece in the beginning of the book about wrestling a lobster on live TV, is an award-winning cookbook author and regional history author in Charlottetown. So, I mean, these are people whose names many, many of you will recognize.
Yeah, and it's actually very nicely put together. What I like about the book also is it's not heavy. When I heard, in one of the approbations there about somebody who was not finding he was looking for something to sue them or whatever it was, and mm-hmm. the books that he was doing, it didn't work, and he picked this up and he read it in one sitting. And it's easy to do because the print, and I'm sure you did this on purpose, the print actually jumps out at you in a very readable way. It's not, the eye-popping stuff.
That was some of the things that I was involved with because, you see, I'm as a publishing consultant, I'm involved in the how the book looks, the design, whereas all three of us, all three editors were involved in the actual editing. We all read everything that came in. We read some things a couple of times. We made editing suggestions. Trudy's piece about her encounter with the Rolling Stones concert in New Brunswick, which is a wonderful, clever piece, was originally two different articles for her local paper, and we asked her to put them together into one, and she said, "Oh, okay, sure." It was quite remarkable how these things came together. There's tremendous variety. The thing I like about the book, we called it Prose to Go because this is a book to pick up and take with you to an appointment or take to bed or take in the car.
And you don't have to worry about getting lost in the middle of a big chapter. All you got to do,
exactly.
These are small.
And you can also pick up and read the things that appeal to you. You may be not in a great mood and not want to read the love and loss section. You may want to read something lighter. Or you may want something laugh out loud funny and read some of the pieces in Exit Laughing. And the sections are balanced. There are 34 stories, but they're spread among the five sections pretty evenly. And we did that deliberately to try to keep them of fairly equal length. And they're all short. They're all 500 to 1,000 words.
That's great. And it's, again, very, very well done. And
thank
as you say, these available here in local bookstores. If they write to your cat Simon Teakettle, is he going to be cooperative in telling them how to get the book?
Well, it's on the website, of course, simonteakettle.com, and it's of course on the Bridge Ross website, bridgeross.com.
Right. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're finally going to let the cat out of the bag with our special connection coming up with Barbara Graham, Barbara Florio Graham. Our number is 613-521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility, a free call, 800-580-2372, our toll-free number, and rbulka@cfra.com, our email address. We're back with Barbara right after these messages.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bulka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Our number is 613-521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, a free call, 800-580-2372, our toll-free number, rbulka@cfa.com, our email address. We're talking with Barbara Florio Graham. We didn't ask you, Barbara, how you got Florio.
Oh, Florio is my maiden name.
Oh, okay, good. So that's simple enough. Folks, some of you may have noticed, if you didn't, then you weren't paying good enough attention to the fact that one of the greats in of acting in our generation, Peter Falk, just recently passed away. And as an irony of ironies, I think very appropriate, one of the pieces in the book Prose to Go is a piece by our very special guest, Barbara Florio Graham, and it's called Before Columbo. And as you could put two and two together, it's before Peter Falk became Columbo. And it's the story of your encounter with him, Barbara, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Of course, no one knew. We can't see into the future. I was a student, a university student in a drama workshop that it was led by, because we, the university's in New York City, was led by an off-Broadway director and producer. And he, this was a very select group. There were about 20 of us, men from Columbia University, women from Barnard, the women's college. And we put on three plays a year, and I was the assistant director on this particular production, which was called The Changeling. It was a post-Shakespeare restoration melodrama with a very serious, heavy villain role. We couldn't cast the villain. We tried everybody within the community that we knew, and we cast all the other parts very easily, and we just couldn't find anybody for the villain. So
what was so difficult?
We just couldn't find anybody who was capable of playing this role and who was available and willing and, you know, to do the rehearsal process, et cetera.
Yeah.
So we had gone throughout the entire university community, and the director came in and he said, look, he said, I have a young man who has just auditioned for me down at the Phoenix Theater, which is the off-Broadway theater he ran. And he said, I think he would work in this role. And I wonder if you guys would be willing to see him. He's only a few years older than you are, so it's not as if we're talking about somebody who's, you know, a great deal older. What do you think? And we said, yeah, okay. So they brought him in, and he was this very, very nice man. He was 27 at the time. We were maybe 20, 21. I was 20. And this very nice young man came in, and he auditioned, and we said, oh, my gosh, he's perfect. So we cast him, and he was willing to do this college production for nothing, no pay. We didn't realize at the time that he was just on the brink of his professional career. He had done nothing to speak of before.
He was
that.
A businessman, right? Who left?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
He was a business had been a business major and had decided that he would try his hand at acting and had come into New York.
I guess
he
business wasn't going so good. I guess business wasn't going so good.
Well, I think actually he was fine, you know, because he had made a good living, and he wasn't an impoverished actor by any reason.
Oh, okay, good.
Any means.
Right.
So, but he moved into Manhattan to see if he could make his way as an actor. And so he auditioned for us. And the interesting thing, before I get to the what's the real story is, I need to tell you that right after he did our play, which, by the way, was seen by several important people in New York, the head of the American Theater Wing, the people who do the Tony Awards, came to our opening night, and several other important friends of our director came, and we didn't realize at the time what was happening, but they were all scouting this guy. And right after he did our play, our director, Norris Houghton, cast him in a fairly small role in Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh, starring Jason Robards.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, a Hollywood scout noticed him, pulled him out to Hollywood, where he was immediately cast in Murder, Inc., for which he won an Oscar nomination. That was all within like a year and a half, 2 years.
That's enough to catapult you into the big time.
It was just remarkable. So we all knew him when we worked with him in one of his last amateur role before he went professional. So this is a play.
And this is Peter Falk.
This is Peter Falk.
And he was known, that was his name then.
Oh, yeah. No, he never changed his
name.
Never
his name, right.
Peter Falk.
Even though it did get changed later
on. One of the reasons why he was so good as the villain is because he had one glass eye. He lost an eye to cancer as a child.
He was 3 years old when he had cancer. Yeah. That's quite amazing. Yeah.
And very handsome man. But this eye was a little bit disconcerting. And our director, Norris Houghton, was brilliant. And he said, we're going to have him come in with his good side, the right side of his face, without that has the real eye, come in with this dashing outfit and a big black cape up in front of the stage, and then come up the stairs onto the stage and turn the other profile to the audience and with the spotlight on him, and he will have this huge red port wine birthmark on that side of his face with the glass eye. Well, let me tell you, the audience gasped. And it really was a wonderful, wonderful production. So everything was going really swimmingly, and we're getting along to the point where we're doing costume fittings and getting done all rehearsals.
And you're getting to like the guy because he's...
Oh, he was wonderful to work with.
Yeah, he's very unassuming.
Very unassuming, very pleasant, very professional. Didn't look down on us at all. He was very respectful to everybody and very considerate to the other actors. He was great. And he was one of us. You know, I mean, we didn't know. We didn't know who he was going to become.
Right.
So we just treated him like everybody else. I mean, I gave him orders like I gave everybody else.
Now, if you go backwards, and I know this is a little bit unfair, but do you see things, or, and I'm sure you probably did this on your own, said, "What I should have picked up the potential greatness in this guy." But you're looking back there, were there any things that you can recall that fit in with where his career went?
Yes. And that is, he was, you know, I worked with, there were a lot of people in that drama workshop who went on to become quite famous and do some terrific things. You recognize talent, and you just accept that the talent is there. You know, just as if you're in an amateur orchestra and you work with a great violinist or a great pianist, you're aware of that at the time. And we certainly were aware of the fact that he was terrific and he was going to become a professional actor. That we didn't doubt, but the kind of career that he would have was astounding. And that was, you know, that was very exciting later to see what happened. And, of course, I wrote about the incident for Emmy magazine a few years later, and then that's the piece that got reprinted again and again and again and ended up in the book.
And this is Prose to Go, right? So
yeah.
Here is this interesting situation, and we sort of set it up. And
okay.
And then...
The setup is that we're doing costumes,
right.
Costume fittings, and this is a play set in, post-Shakespeare's time, and he needs to be wearing tights. Well, I mean, that's fine. And he comes to me and he says, I need a jockstrap.
that's what was the words that he used.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the word he used. And right. I didn't know what a jockstrap was. I was a Catholic girl who was brought up in a family, as you heard earlier, of three girls. I had no clue. I had a vague idea that it was something, you know, that had to do with athletics.
Right, so we call it now an athletic supporter.
Yeah, but right, no, yeah. I didn't even know that was what it was called.
Right, yeah.
So he says, I need a jockstrap. And I said, very professionally, I said to him, oh, well, of course, Peter, you just buy anything you need, and you just bring me the bill, because I have a petty cash fund. And he said, the only time he was not, I felt, thoroughly kind and generous, he said, no, he said, you're the assistant director. You get it. Well, I wasn't about to say no.
Yeah, but that's very interesting because this is something which is not one size fits all.
Well, I didn't know that.
Right. But he would have known that. So why did he ask you to do it?
I don't know. But he probably was preoccupied. He wasn't being mean or
condescending
anything.
or authoritarian.
No.
I think he
was preoccupied and busy, and he just didn't have time to go and do stuff. Remember, he was auditioning for an important role. He was learning a role. We didn't know about that, but he was learning a role which would make his career. And here he was in this amateur production doing his very best, knowing all his lines and blocking and everything else. He just didn't want to be bothered with any details.
Okay, so we're going to take a break now, and we're going to come back. We will find out what happened. We're talking to Barbara Florio
Graham. I think you have to read the book to find out what happened.
Oh, you don't want to tell anybody? 613-521-8255 is our main number. Star 580 on Bell Mobility is a free call if you're on the Bell Mobility system. 800-580-2372, our toll-free number. And rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. We're back with Barbara Florio Graham right after these messages.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bolka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our program. We are in conversation with Barbara Florio Graham, very distinguished lady of letters. Our number is 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, a free call. 800-580-2372 is our toll-free number, and rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. Barbara.
Yes.
So you have full rights to say you want to know what happened, buy the book.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending of the story.
Okay, that's good. But I did want to ask you whether there is any particular piece in the book that you would like to share with our audience.
Oh, gosh, there are so many.
The one that I thought might be a good one is the one that actually launched it. It's a little bit maybe on the sad side, the one from Barbara.
Giorgio, yeah. It's so moving. And the interesting thing about that piece, as I say, is that she wrote that. Nobody ever changed a word. And when we got back to people, in the course of editing, we said, we need your final sign-off on how we've edited, any changes we've made. And we did have to make changes. For example, everything in the book, we changed all the Canadian spellings and references to American.
Why?
Well, that was a big debate. And we were two against one on that with the editors. But Bridge Ross sells very widely. The book is in the UK. It's in Australia. We've already had reviews from the UK.
All the more reason to do it the Canadian way, the States.
No, in the States. And we felt, and because I do a lot of writing for the U.S., I find that many times bookstores and reviewers in the U.S. Do feel a book is limited if it is so Canadian that they feel maybe that their American readers might be put off by the spellings and so forth. So we didn't use kilometers. We didn't use driving alpacas, for example. We changed all the spellings, and it turned out to be a very smart idea in the long run. And as I say, what we did with the editors is that whenever we weren't absolutely in a full agreement about something, it was majority rules. So Irene was the primary editor, but she did not get the last word except on grammar. And I didn't get the last word just because it's my list. I mean, we were very democratic about that. In fact, even the title, Prose to Go, Tales from a Private List, all the contributors voted on both the title and the subtitle. There were a whole bunch of titles put out there. and a whole bunch of subtitles, and we voted on both of them and came up with what we felt, came up with the consensus that everybody agreed with. Everybody agreed on the cover design. The only thing we didn't get everybody's input on were the five sections, because it took us quite a while to decide which piece belonged where. Some of them were obvious, like the Love and Loss pieces. One of them about Irene's father, which is very, very sweet, very sentimental. It's not sad per se. It's more love than loss. And one about a friend and a pen pal. There are several there. And the Exit Laughing ones were easy, but there were several that could have easily belonged in Exit Laughing, and it ended up elsewhere in order to balance the book. So there were a lot more funny pieces than anything else.
Very good. You know, it's interesting, the front cover, if you look at it very carefully, there's lots of Canadian in it, but it has an interesting, if you look at it from the top part of it, it would almost look like a springtime picture because it's lots of greens, and at the bottom you have snow. It's almost like it was taken in a time warp.
Well, the interesting thing about the cover is that I said, as we were working with it, I said, I see the cover as, I'd like to see like a door, a glass door with lots of different panes, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Something, well, this is after we had the title. And I said, let's see, you know, we've got some very good photographers in the group, and let's see who can come up with something. And Steve said, oh, well, I think I have something that'll work. And he said, it's a boathouse on my property. And I said, well, so much the better, because then we don't have to get into worrying about the rights, to the photograph, to if the photo was taken on your own property, then you don't have any problems with that. And he had taken one first in the spring, and then when we started working with the cover designer, John Watson, who was Julie Watson's son, Julie Watson of the Lobster Wrestling.
Right.
Julie's son, who is a wonderful photographer, professional photographer, and he does all her book cover designs. And John said, I think I'd like another photo. And Steve said, yeah, but it's now getting on to winter, and there's snow on the ground. And John said, it's okay. So this was taken in probably October. Now, the trees in the background are not deciduous trees. They're mostly evergreens on his property, but there was still a lot of green, and this is a pretty fresh snow. So I think it sort of gives you a feeling of all seasons.
Right.
I love it, and it's a boathouse. It's an old boathouse on his property in North Bay.
We're very pleased about the photo. And one window is boarded up.
Yeah.
It's an interesting photo.
So it's got
photo.
The five sections. Well, I think it was John who made that one pane opaque so that he would get the five sections for the five signposts.
Yeah, right. Even though the signposts don't correlate with the window, they're pointing in different directions, but it's around the window. It's good. It's a very nice cover.
Thank you.
It's a very, very colorful cover. And
we were pleased that we were able to do everything in-house, every single bit of it, but done by the group.
And, of course, you know, the question that everyone asks when you do a book like this is there a more prose to go in the offing? In other words, good book. Then, you know, you really set yourself up good. You have prose to go, then you have more prose to go, then you have even more prose to go. So you got three books right away.
Well, would you believe that almost as soon as we finish this, somebody posted something to the list, and somebody said, oh, well, that has to go in prose to go, too. And I said, oh, no, let us get this one published and promoted before we start collecting for a second. But they really are. I mean, there's enough stuff being generated on this list all the time. There was a very funny piece from Steve Pitt about losing hydro on his property after a big storm and going out in his very first, he's only been in North Bay for less than a year, his very first experience with a chainsaw, and oh dear, there's another piece for sure. And Fred has certainly written at least two more that would go in.
So you would
book.
Restrict anything in there to your private list? In other words, this would, this, To get into this book, you have to be in the private list.
Yeah, and the private list is closed. You can't join. We've had people, since the book came out, somebody said, oh, darn.
Pretty please, can I? Yeah, okay.
I wish I'd joined your list. And I said, well, it's too late now.
Right. So I want to go back before we get to your reading. Peter Falk.
Yeah.
Did you maintain any contact with him after?
Yes. After the piece was in Emmy Magazine, I contacted him and sent it to him, and he had already seen it. His publicist had come across it and seen it. And I was already corresponding with Norris Houghton, the director and producer at the Phoenix. I had maintained a correspondence with him after graduation. And he then, so I sent it to him, and he then forwarded it to Patton Campbell, the professional costume designer who worked with us. And Patton wrote to me, and he said, oh, my gosh, Peter Falk hated tights all his life. That was his first experience with tights. So, yes, I didn't hear back from Peter, but I know that he saw it and that he read it.
Do you think there was anything in it that he may not have liked?
No.
So in other words, there was communication, but there was no, shall we say, conscious awareness of the communication.
Well, he didn't actually get back to me, but I understand that. I mean, he was in contact with these other people within his own field.
Right,
and so, he was a very, very big star then in Hollywood. So, you know, he probably was receiving an awful lot of mail from all sorts of people. And I'm sure that all went through his publicist and his assistant.
From the time that you had that experience with him to the time that disappeared in Emmy, how many years went?
I think it appeared in Emmy Magazine in the early 70s, I think. It was a long time.
So a long time in between.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this happened in 1955. And it was only after I moved to Canada and began. I was a teacher and worked in PR and then as a teacher in New York and Chicago. And it was only after I came to Canada and began to freelance full time that I sort of looked around and said, what experiences do I have that would be worth writing about? And, you know.
And there you go. When you heard that he died, did that probably tugged at your emotional strings, I would imagine?
Well, it did, except that I knew. I have followed his career. I bought his autobiography. I had followed his career. I knew that he had dementia. I knew that he was in very bad shape the past couple of years. So I really was expecting this.
It's irony because in Columbo, he plays the part of a dumb cop, you know. Who disarms people by his apparent stupidity, even though he ends up being brilliant. But
he wrote many of those later episodes and directed quite a lot of them. He was a very smart man.
We're going to take a break now, Barbara, because I'm looking at the clock and I want you to be able to read that selection from your namesake. 613-521-8255. Is our main number, Star 580 on Bell Mobility, a free call, 800-580-2372, our toll-free number, and rbulka@cfra.com is our email address. We're back with our final segment with this lovely lady, Barbara Florio-Graham, right after these messages.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bulka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Welcome back, folks. This is the final segment of our program, a very entertaining and stimulating program. We're talking with one of the preeminent writers who is responsible for lots of good writing, not only coming out of her own pen, but out of others who have learned the skills that she has honed herself. Barbara Florio-Graham, it's been a pleasure having you, Barbara. And I'm delighted also to be able to present to our audience your latest publication venture that you've done together with Irene Davis and Fred Desjardins. It's Prose to Go, Tales from a Private List. It's available at the Big Stuff. You can also lock into www.simonteakettle.com. If you want more information about how to get the book, you can get it in Chapters and other good places. And before we even get into any other conversation, I want to make sure we get this in before the end of the program. The launch article that you say is the centerpiece that everything else evolved around and developed from is the one, My Life Now, by Barbara Bunce Massabuio.
You know what? I don't want to read that.
You don't want to read that one?
I don't want to read it because I'm concerned that Barbara would consider that maybe a violation.
Okay, so which
I want to read for you, because this brings us right back to the very beginning when I was telling you about being the one of three sisters in my family, and this also is the only piece in the book that includes the cat, and Simon T. Kettle insists that I read this one.
Okay, got it.
It's Crickets.
Ah, good.
Can I read Crickets?
Absolute. Yeah, I actually caught it. You asked about what are you doing with Crickets. That's the one that is in the book on page 137.
That's right.
Okay, go for it. I think that's a very wise decision.
I don't have many fears. I'm not afraid of the water, heights, speaking in public, or snakes. But I'm terrified of insects. My panic at seeing a spider is totally irrational and often hysterical. So what am I doing with a cricket in my office? My mother claims my fear of insects is inherited from her. But if that were true, why would my dread be so much worse than that of my sisters? I do recall that all four of us, my mother, both sisters, and I, were diligent in our Saturday morning efforts to keep our typical Cape Cod house free of cobwebs, and that Daddy was used to hearing a thin female voice heightened in fear, summoning him from downstairs just as he sat down after supper to read the paper. His muscled, weary body would trudge up the oak staircase, and responding to a dumb gesture pointing to the corner where the ceiling joined the rose-papered wall, he would grasp the unsuspecting spider in his rough automobile mechanic's hands as we covered our eyes and turned away. So what am I doing with a cricket in my office? Insects make me hysterical. When I was about six, one of my sisters, exasperated with my intrusion on her privacy in the room we shared, closed me inside, holding the door shut from the hallway while whispering, "I just saw a spider in there." As my frantic eyes searched every corner and my hands brushed my hair, my clothes, my arms, my legs, certain something was crawling on me, I heard her malicious giggle, and I began to scream. There was no spider, of course, which she confessed as soon as she realized that her prank was out of control. And I remember she was punished severely, although I was still so upset I took no relish in it. But that still doesn't explain what I'm doing with a cricket in my office. I didn't kill a spider myself until I was 25 years old and living in Chicago. I've been told insects don't live in the higher floors of skyscrapers and was reassured by the fact that my apartment was on the 42nd floor. But 2 months after I moved in, I found a tiny black spider. At first, I recoiled in panic, keeping my gaze fixed on the intruder so he couldn't slip into some crack to hide where I'd have to endure forever the fear of his reappearance. Then I realized there was no Daddy downstairs to call, and I would either have to deal with the spider myself or watch helplessly as it crawled out of my sight to keep me awake for years to come. I stood transfixed, sweat beginning to soak my armpits and forehead. Slowly, I steadied myself against the dresser with my right hand and reached with my left for one of the slippers I knew were beside the bed. Carefully transferring it to my right hand, as I was afraid if I missed, my courage would be for naught, I lifted the slipper and smashed the six-legged monster with all the force of my fear. It left no mark on the windowsill, just a tiny brown spot on the sole of the slipper, which scraped off with a double tissue that I flushed down the toilet, shuddering all the while. After I stopped shaking, I was proud of my accomplishment. Still, more than two decades after that triumph, I shiver every time I see an insect. So what am I doing with a cricket in my office? It happened by accident. A few years ago, when we were visiting my parents in Florida, my ex-husband caught two of those little lizards that are always crawling up the downspouts. He managed to get them through Canada Customs, still squirming, and placed them in the smaller of our two terrariums, which happens to reside in my office. The cat was delighted, and so was I, until my husband announced that all lizards, our geckos included, eat only live food. That meant insects in my office. The two as yet unnamed reptiles were banished to the basement to live in the larger terrarium. Simon Teakettle followed, and I heaved a sigh of relief. Then I heard a tiny chirping. One of the crickets the lizard had dined on just moments before had found a hiding place and now celebrated his escape with joyful sound. My first instinct was to shout, "Peter," in the same quavering voice with which I'd called Daddy years ago. But then I took a deep breath and thought about this brave young creature. Was I going to condemn him to death after he'd miraculously defied the jaws of two hungry geckos? Wasn't it true that the Chinese considered a cricket in the house to be lucky? I decided to keep the cricket and call him Bravo. Bravo called my office terrarium home. We realized that he was a she when two smaller crickets appeared. We called them Echo and Forte. They lived in a mini Eden, complete with jar-top dishes of cornmeal and water. I gave them pretty rocks and shelves to climb on and hide under, and twice-weekly servings of lettuce to nibble. They were very happy, so happy, in fact, that soon more tiny baby crickets began to appear. Oops! When Simon Teakettle was asleep, I carried the terrarium onto the front porch, removed the cover, turned it on its side, and allowed the crickets to escape. Years later, when I opened the front screen door in late August, Simon and I can hear the crickets singing. It's not a bad sound if you don't mind insects.
Very beautiful. And this actually appeared once in the Ottawa Citizen.
Yes, it was. And it's now in Prose to Go, Tales from a Private List, available at Books on Beechwood and Amazon and Indigo and Chapters and everywhere else.
Very good. And actually, you know, you read very well.
Oh, thank you. I'm a former broadcaster.
There you go. So you do well. And I hate to tell you, but I'm looking at the good clock and we're angling close to the end of the program. So again, thank you very, very much for sharing this with us. It's this is an excellent read. And the good thing about it, folks, is that you don't have to read the book at one fell swoop. These are little snippets, and each snippet is sort of like self-contained and is a story of its own, like the one that you just heard from Barbara. So, Barbara, thank you very, very, very much. It's been a pleasure having you.
It's been delightful. Thank you, Rabbi.
And I wish you luck, and I hope that you don't give up on the idea of... I would never go Prose to Go, too. I would go to more Prose to Go.
Oh, well, we'll have to all collaborate on the title like we did the first time.
There you go. And then you may want to suggest to them that maybe they want to put in, just for Canadian pride purposes, maybe the next one should be more Canadian Prose to Go. Right?
Good idea.
Even if you keep the American spelling, but it really is Canadian stuff.
Yes, it is. I'm very Canadian.
So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All the very best. Thank you, Barbara Florio-Graham. And folks, thank you very, very much for joining us these 2 hours. And stay tuned to CFRA. Lots of good stuff over the course of the week. And we'll be back next Sunday night right after the 9 o'clock news. In the meantime, stay well.